stop living on the 11th.
Something like
well, it's seems 40 like. Degrees.
Yeah. Okay, so it's the 17th, Monday the 17th of March, and yes, it is 40 degrees for about the, what is it, 10th day in a row or
something? Oh, no, I think it's the 14th now.
Oh, how lovely.
Or maybe that's the 11th. But it's pretty damn hot.
And it's Leanne Gould interviewing Anne Newmarch. We're returning again, and we're going to talk about a book that you did the artwork for schools, which was Improving on the Blank Page.
I don't know that it was initially designed to be on the school curriculum. It was a really fascinating selection of poems by Keith Galash and Deborah McCulloch, and I was invited to be their illustrator. I knew them both really well, and they knew my work, and I think I did quite an amazing job on that, actually, because it's not like in one person's style. Every poem has been interpreted as a reading of the poem. So you don't see anything like an Anne Newmarch style. I've used everything possible to think about what could encourage the kids that read the poem to have more reading of the poem in the illustrations. So the illustrations were like my master, René Magritte, the artist, who always had a disparate or a, what would you call it, a distance or a closeness between his painting and its title. He titled nearly all of his works after having little soirees or whatever you'd call them back then with his poet friends. And they were all named, not by him, but by their poet friends. And I always found the space in between, and I have all the time in my work, the space in between the canvas or the image and its title. And that's a space, I think, that is really so important in every piece of artwork, to have that space. I mean, some people say, I like art, I can just read straight away. Well, I give them some of that, but then there's a lot more in between, or they might say, why do that for this? And then they have to think. So there's a creative process that goes on in the reader or in the viewer's brain, whether it be poetry reading, as in this book, or my own exhibitions. There's a space around it that's not mine. Well, I know it's there, but I don't define it. I give it some clues, and that book gave me a wonderful opportunity with some of the poems to interpret for themselves, a reading for themselves about poetry, and an image just to spark something. And it won a Rigby Award for Design, which I guess in commas basically was mine. But also the selection of poetry was really lovely and really exciting for high school students, and it was put on the high school students' curriculum for many years, except, as I said before, in one Catholic school I learned that 300 books were burnt because of one image of a pumpkin with a stem going into it. And I find that really, in fact, we all found that really, really amusing. But it was very well received. It did win an award, and I think the reputation of 300 books being burnt is really good. Makes me feel fantastic.
And that would have been in the 1970s, roughly? That would have been
done. Have a look at the...
Something like that, I think, wasn't it?
Yeah.
1972.
Yeah. Right. Yeah. And the whole idea of being the illustrator for it was, as I said, in every visual, room for thought. And then at the back, there's a whole series of photographs that... the kids could make poems about. There weren't any poems there, they're just images of demonstrations, a bed, a mask, and black kids, two windows in a cell, a broken down door, the door handle, in fact, of my office at the art school. But they were there to provoke, and there's someone skinning a rat.
Did you ever receive feedback that anybody had written poetry? Or do you know whether the two poets involved there had ever received feedback?
I don't know. I imagine they probably would have. Mm. But this
very
one that you have...
provoking images. They're fantastic.
This is the student's version. There's another one, which was the teacher's version, that has ways of using the book as a teaching method of writing poetry. So it was suggesting all sorts of ways in which the images at the back or other images that the students found could promote their beginning to write poetry. So that was lovely. So it wasn't just the book as we've got here. It also had a teacher's version. And I thought that was very constructive.
That's great. Okay, now we were also going to talk about the playgrounds in Prospect, that you had a big role in getting established playgrounds and parks in Prospect.
Well, I didn't really have a very big job, but it was part of the community association, which Brian and I were part of, to say there's a real lack of space for kids. And I guess it was understandable that the neighbourhood was changing with a lot of old folk moving and a lot of new folk with kids moving in. And yet there were really no spaces at all, hardly any. So we formed a group called the Playgrounds Group. Now, that wasn't just me, it was all of the Prospect community, and I guess prompted by Brian Medlin and myself to form a group to look at that. And we brought in speakers from playground making by communities all over the world. There's one that we did a poster for, a guy from Sweden and another from England, that had looked at community playgrounds and how the community could actually build, and the kids also could help build their own playing area. You know, using junk, disposable things, whatever. Now, for council, that was a little bit too radical. But they did start putting aside vacant blocks, which was our suggestion. When a place becomes vacant by the block, if the house has been torn down, and make it into a little park. And that began to happen more and more. And it was really successful, but it was not in my hands. I didn't have anything to do from then on. Except I did in... I'm going to have to look at my CV to find out when... 1 year I did a show at the Thousand Words Gallery where I went to work in every single play space and open space in Prospect, and I just sat there and drew it, and then had an exhibition of all the spaces, and it was like a prize for council to say, look at what you've done, this is fantastic, you've actually done this on your own behalf, and the gardeners were so pleased with it, and they were lovely drawings, and quite a few were bought by council and hung in the council depot thing, but lots of people bought them because they were the playgrounds that they brought their children to when they were tiny tots too. So I do think it was one of my loveliest shows, actually. It was because it was about Prospect. It was very personal, and it did mean also meeting people. As I worked there with my crayons and pencils and whatever, I'd meet people who either used or didn't use or wanted something to change, but it was really a community-orientated exhibition, I suppose, because it wasn't just me going there, photographing it, taking it into, doing it in my studio. I actually did it on the spot, and so people could come and see me work. But it really was in praise of Prospect for actually carrying through the idea that that the community association had had in the first place?
Well, the end result of that was that, or the lasting result of that is that in Prospect, is it there's a park every, is it 500 metres or every kilometre? You don't have to walk more than 500 metres or you don't have to walk more than a kilometre to find a park. And that's right throughout Prospect now. So that's as a result of
well,
that
you would know that more than me. I just got in my car and walked. I didn't have a pedometer on.
No, I just remember reading somewhere in the council notes that,
well,
that
I mean,
as a result of...
very proud of
their parts. Oh, it is. It's something
parts.
To be proud of.
Mm. Yes, I think so.
Something I keep on thinking constantly as we're going through your interview, that it should be very, very satisfying for you to live in this area and have constant, you know, be surrounded by all of the wonderful changes, positive changes that you've made to this area.
Yes, it certainly is in some ways, Leanne, but the other thing is I now have a neighbour that wants to put up a 6-foot fence around his property and hem me in. So that's also still happening as people with community values move out. He says, oh, I recognise you want to be open to the community around you, but excuse me, we want our private space. So with the law, I have to allow him to have his 1.8 metre fence. And it's incredibly sad and incredibly tiring to deal with a neighbour who, for 32 years, I've had neighbours that I loved and we'd even chat through the kitchen windows.
Do you think that's the new society?
Well, it was already happening soon after we moved into Prospect, but I think it stopped happening for a while when the Community Association was really active. And I think I told you before of the place on the corner. Was that on tape or whatever?
Not sure.
Place on the corner of Fernort and Beatrice, where I live, they started putting up an 8-foot-high brush fence. I thought, oh my God, okay. So I wrote them a note and put it in their letterbox. And I said, I'm so pleased to see you've only put up half of it. And it's a wonderful idea that you have that bit of privacy. But leave the rest open, because otherwise no one will see the beautiful architecture of your house. Now, I don't know whether that had any effect or not, but they didn't complete their fence. I mean, but that's kind of a joke more than anything else.
Okay. Now, built imagination. I never did quite get the hang of built imagination.
Oh, okay. Well, after I was artist in residence, the community arts officer in Prospect, who was Ian Hamilton then, suggested that a residency was really important. And the first one was Quentin... Oh, I can't remember his last name. Quentin Crisp? No, that's the homosexual, isn't it? Quentin...
The actor.
Mm. Anyway, you can find that out. Mm. He's a musician and he's a friend of Graham Dudley's, or an associate. And I saw him the other night and he played for the most wonderful play. So Quentin became musician in residence, which was very different from artist in residence, and he did a lot of wonderful work there. And then I think the next one was after that was kind of artist architecture working together. So there was an artist, which was David Kerr, and an architect called Rick Bazzali. So they worked together on a number of different notions and themes. And they also had an agenda where they employed, or not employed really, but asked other artists who lived in Prospect to look at how they would design a streetscape between council and the library. And some of the designs, they were all put up on display, some of the designs were so beautiful. What's her name? Sarah Crowhurst. Had a lovely idea of mosaics in colour leading from council to the library. I did another one which was to do with, I think, street planting and whatever. But there are a lot of different ideas, but none of them really got incorporated except possibly the art walk, which is the pavement stones, which I don't think it was good at first. It was a nice idea, but they a bit innocuous. You know the ones I mean?
Yeah,
You know, the terracotta pavement things, but you've got to kind of find them.
Yes, where everybody has a...
for visual ways in which to... And I thought that was great. Yeah. And they did some designs for other things too, and one for crossings with different paving bricks to make Persian carpets on the Prospect Road, which unfortunately have become covered with car oil. Mm. But they couldn't put down polished tiles because that'd be too slippery for the pedestrians. But it was a good project, I think. And then after that, I'm not sure of the history of it yet. After the Built Imagination, I think probably the gallery started to be being looked at. But Gay would know more about that, and probably people from council would know more about that too. And then the Stovepole project happened, and then underground wiring happened, and some of the stoves had to come down, and got their tops chopped off and stuck up by the art gallery, which is good. And I brought this in for you to have a look at. This was an idea of, I tried to find the form. These were ideas for story poles. And this one with the humbugs.
Isn't that gorgeous? And where is that one? Because that one's actually around
still
somewhere.
There. This was written by a councillor. He was so pleased that his poem was recognised. Because there's so many people, I mean, I think the whole community thing in Prospect was about recognising people's talent. Now, is this going to blur the... Anyway, just don't worry.
That's all right. Yep, as long as you can see.
This was the design where it was the proper project then. Please lodge these details with the project coordinator, Prospect Council, and you'll be... This will be returned to you before starting painting. So this is one I put in of four black and white humbugs. And it's on a totally huge electrical pole. And one of the councillors wrote this poem. Neighbours aren't perfect, it's plain to see, but then again, neither are we. And I thought it's great. And I've repainted a couple of times, but I think it's getting pretty old. Well, it's now.
It'd be
25
years old. And this one with the ribbons as well, that's one that...
Yes, that was for Prospect Fair.
Yeah.
And that's one that was moved up to the council. But I like the ones with the envelopes and stamps too, which could go near the post office. So there are a lot of really wonderful designs. They're like small art spaces that allow the community to be imaginative. Find their own small spaces. So they're like small murals. Murals are thought of as being big murals, big things. But I try to introduce the idea of them being little things, small spaces, personal spaces, because everyone can't be involved in a big mural, but the little ones. Or I thought maybe letterboxes would be a good idea, or front gates or front doors, but the story pole was just the right size and was available size wise for people to think about what they would like to do.
And they always were such an ugly thing too. They were such a big, industrial
size. Horrible. Well, the one next to the humbugs, I did paint that a few times. But it's right on the curb, and even now it's smashed through here. Now, several times I've been down there, and I poured some of my own blood into it, because it's so dangerous. And then I thought, oh, well, I can't really afford that. I need to keep my own blood for my own projects. So I'd inject red paint into it, running stuff, so it would run as though the whole stove pole was bleeding where it was broken. I must say, I'm still tempted now. It's broken now. One night, I might go down again with my little dentist injection thing and just
squeeze a bit more.
Squeeze a bit of paint in there. I have done some very naughty things. I know when all the gun shops moved into Prospect, I was horrified, really horrified. And one was just around the corner to me. And I didn't feel safe walking at night because there'd be really strange people, men, of course, looking at all this ammunition and all the guns in the gun shop. So one night when it was a bit quiet, I had my, what do you call them, syringe filled with blood, and I put it in their keyhole. It was running through the keyhole and dripping out the bottom of their door. So when they opened it the next morning, they were a bit surprised. Well, you can't be conservative forever, can you?
No, you can't.
But I mean, it's the cheeky things you do, Leanne. They are really the things that spark off new ideas too. You think, oh, I've got to, can't do that. Oh, I can't do that. I know so many people that say, oh, I say, what about doing this? Oh, no, I couldn't do that. I couldn't do that. But my whole role as a teacher was to say, you can. And look, I can do it. You can do it too. And not only with, I don't really mean pouring blood into keyholes, but in lots and lots of ways in terms of being creative. And I think that was good for Prospect during that time. Okay, what's next?
We were going to talk about T-shirts.
I don't know where you're going to fit this in because it's much earlier.
Okay.
And it's really when I was working in.
So what sort of what time frame would it be?
Oh, I meant to bring one up, didn't I?
That's all right.
The 70s,
yeah.
Up to 76, 78, I suppose. And I used to design them when I just left art school or even as a student. I'd have people or book in to have a specialised, individualised T-shirt that said such and such with an image. So I had a little screen with an alphabet on it in various style of writing, and I'd just run them all off separately. It was just my little sideline bit of pocket money. But then I did one for the BLF, which of course was the Eureka flag, and one that I think, well, I loved them because I also screened that onto my son's nappies and various other kids' nappies, the Eureka flag. And another one that was nationalised GMH. It's when GMH was being taken over by America, and General Motors Holden, being an Australian firm, was then General Motors American. And there was a lot of protests about that. And so it's a beautiful image of an old FJ with nationalised GMH, or no, it was nationalised the Holden. I've still got some.
That
some
would have been
ones.
Right at the beginning of America buying out Australian icons.
Yes, it was. Yeah. It was all about, I mean, and the Eureka flag too. It's all about Australian independence from big capital buying us out to America. And I mean, I did a lot of posters. Nationalised the car industry is one that's in fact being shown in America, in the WAC exhibition, that's touring America, and we'll then be touring the world. That's when I did of showing the screen print, not a T-shirt, of guys on the line saying just nationalise the car industry for us. I was very active through that time, and I mean, sometimes you forget those things. But just looking at, I came across these, and it was another, they're all upside down all over the place, but there was the no uranium mining activity.
This is to go with the free zone, the nuclear free zone.
Oh no, this was years before the nuclear free zone thing in Prospect. And it was a group that was against uranium mining, so I just volunteered, and I didn't get paid, of course, but they've all got messages on the back if you want to have a look. Do you read a
couple? Can I photocopy these as well to put in the file?
Sure, so yes, of course. Yep, you
okay.
Can.
Okay.
Look, they were done from my research with my own doctor about the effects of radioactivity on pregnant women.
So this one says, please stop uranium mining, and it has a photo of a newborn baby, and it says, this is the land of our children. They will follow only if they can, and then on the back of it, it's got up the top, encephaly, only one result of radioactive contamination. And then it says, dear friend, what will we say to our grandchildren when they cry, you could have stopped them, it's your fault. Bring a friend to the next rally, every person counts.
Is that the same as what I've got here? Except I would emphasise, what will we say when our grandchildren, to our grandchildren when they cry? You could have stopped them. Different emphasis. This is the land of our children. They will follow only if they can. Bring a friend to the next rally. So they're all a little bit different. Dear friend, unhappiness for millions, profits for a handful. Can your family afford it? They're all a bit different. There's pink ones, orange ones, blue ones, brown ones, etc. Mm. But yes, I'll leave those with you.
If I could. Thank you. That'd be
terrific.
There's
a little bag for them.
Thank you.
But, I mean, that's just sort of like a... I guess the T-shirts were too. A lot of my work was just socially active stuff that you don't get any credit or money for. You lay out everything. But it doesn't matter because you are being radical, I suppose, but I didn't see it so much as being radical, it was just political, and as my retrospective says, the person is political. And I couldn't not see things happening that I could be involved in, since I was getting a salary as a lecturer in art. So basically my salary provided the possibilities for doing these personal things.
Mm. Huge amounts.
And this was also a lovely one that's very famous now. Women hold up half the sky. But I brought it in today because I keep finding things when I'm cleaning up, Leanne. It's incredible. These are printed as postcards, which you would have seen plenty by now.
And this is in whacked as well, isn't it?
That's in whack, yes. Yeah. Yep. Well, it needs to be. But there was a whole exhibition around that as its front cover called Women Hold Up Half the Sky by the Art Gallery of South Australia that travelled, was a touring show. But what I found incredible is that it was printed as a postcard by the Art Gallery of South Australia, the Art Gallery of Victoria and the National Gallery of Australia. And they're all slightly different. But to have three galleries do huge runs of one image is really quite lovely, I think. I like that very much. I didn't get paid for it, of course, but all you get is a bit of kudos, but a bit of kudos is not too bad.
And that's your Auntie Peg, isn't it?
That's my Auntie Peg.
Yeah. Yeah. And she was an amazing woman.
She was indeed.
Mm. Do you want to talk about her? Because you've made a book there about her.
Yes, I guess it was... I don't quite know how to put it. It wasn't just about feminism, which is now, I heard on the radio, a dirty word this morning on Radio National, but it was about wanting to produce something for an audience that was different from the ones that I'd been reaching, which were basically working class people, about their role in protests against America and multinationals. I wanted to make something because I had a little boy and I was kind of criticised because it was a boy, not a girl. So I did that series of 10 years of images of my kids. That's in that one aspect of my life book. And I thought that was really important to... Well, I thought it was really silly to say you've got to have boys. I mean, it really was quite ridiculous. But that's the feminist separatists, and I didn't agree with any of their principles in any case. But I want to do something about Peg, because she was... My mother came from a working class family. I don't know how much of this you want to think about. Should I go on? Mm. My grandfather was an alcoholic Glaswegian publican. And my mother was born in Glasgow, and she came out here when she was 13, because Nana had by then 7 children, whilst he just mucked around with alcohol and was really very nasty man, really. And then he met up with this chick that was going to Australia, and he eloped. Whatever. He left his wife and six kids in Glasgow and ran away to Australia. Oh, I love this bit, Leanne. He sold women's lingerie in country towns. Charlie, his name was, and I can just imagine a drunken Charlie going door to door in country towns trying to sell lace lingerie to country women. Amazing. But obviously the woman he ran away with must have run away too, so he sent for his wife and 6 children to come to Australia. So they did, and my mother said she was 12 or 13 when they came out, and she had all her teeth removed because she only weighed a fraction of what she should have. She was really underweight, undernourished. They were all very poor, and all her teeth were rotten, and they pulled them all out. I think there was... No, maybe there was 7. Maybe that 8th was born here. But Grandpa and Nana got back together somehow or other. And my mother started work... Oh, I don't need to say this, because the story is actually in the book of Prospect, Recollections of Prospect. She had no teeth, and she was stuck in the back factory of dear Mrs. Gray's workshop, knitting on knitting machines, until it took her a year to earn enough money to get some teeth. Then she was allowed out into the front of the store. Oh. My mother was the most beautiful woman in the world. I think everyone's mother is, probably, but I thought my mother was just fabulous. I can't imagine this poor 13, 14-year-old teenager having to run this knitting machine backwards and forwards, with no teeth and having no one ever view her. But Peg was her little sister. Oh, I'm not sure, actually. Yes, I think she was a bit younger than Mum. And she was one of twins. And because of money, malnutrition, whatever, the other twin died. So Peggy was a twin, identical twin. And I don't know how she felt the loss. I haven't really talked to her. Oh, I didn't. She's dead now. I didn't really talk to her about that. But she really was working class. Now, my mother was hidden away for so long that she then, when she got her teeth, got to be known by my father, who was lower middle class, if you talk about those class structures. I'll go back to that if you remind me, the class structure. And my grandmother totally disapproved of my father's interest in my mother. So anyway, she kept working in the knitting shop, and she really wanted to be upward climbing to middle class. But Peg was quite concerned. Anyway, she had 8 children herself, so she didn't have any time to think about being mobilely upward or upward mobile. So she works. She worked 2 hours a day, two jobs a day, and her husband was a really rotter, that one that she's holding up in the picture. He'd beat her up, he'd get put in jail, and he'd get out of the jail, and he'd hide in the bushes. When Peg came home from work, he'd beat her up again, get put back in jail, hide in the bushes till Peg came back from her second job, beat her up again, etc. So there's a real irony in the image of women hold up half the sky, and it was a bit by a group of people who said, oh, come on, Peg, you think you're so good. Oh, you couldn't hold up a man. So she just picked him up. But it's amazingly emotional to me, because I know her husband, who's called Cyril, was a really nasty, nasty piece of work. But she would work two jobs with eight kids. She'd come home at night about 12 or 1 from her second job, and she'd built herself a little wooden, or maybe two little wooden boxes, and she'd mix up some concrete, and she'd pour 2 or 3 bricks a night.
This was just before the war, or during the war, when there were no building supplies available, wasn't it? So housing was...
Oh, I don't know. Oh, no, I think it was after that. She was so poor she couldn't afford to buy a brick.
Yeah. But I thought that was when you couldn't buy them either. The house that she built was an austerity, wasn't it?
I think it was actually after our house was built, and that was red brick. So I think it's just because she really couldn't afford to buy any bricks. So she built it herself, and then she got a little bit of help to put window frames. It was a very crude little house for her and her 8 children. So that's why I decided to write. This is the house that Peg built. She was the most leathered-looking woman as a child I can ever remember. Her hands were like, they had leather gloves on them. Her face was like leather. All of her was so strong and leather-like. And my mother, who was much more trying to be a dainty lady, kind of looked down a bit on Peg, because Peg was working class and my mother was hopefully upwardly rising. But I love Peg because she was so... I can't think of the word. She didn't care about anybody else's views. She had a husband in prison, then she had a husband out, got beaten up, had a husband in prison. She had to look out for 6, 8 children and build a house at the same time. So her hands were rough. Her hands tended to her children. Her hands, what's it say in there? There's lots of different ways of looking at hands.
That, yes,
Peggy and has loving hands. Peggy has working hands. Peggy has...
There was a lovely bit in here that you wrote about how she had clever hands
Yes. Oh, and you said were clever hands. Yes.
Oh, yeah. And you said she had no money to pay people for work to work for her. She had to learn about electricity, plumbing, how to build cupboards and tables,
no idea.
How to mend a car, make a garden, curtains, cakes, lace, cement and wedding dresses, how to use a hammer, wrench, knitting needles, shifting spanner, electric saw, hacksaw, fret saw, gimlet, concrete mixer and cake decorator.
Do you know what a gimlet is?
I'm not sure.
Well, when I went down to visit her is when I got her oral history, like you're doing now, and I realised what incredible skills she had. Not only from raising children, but she actually knew how to make lace. And she'd built from... This is when she'd shifted from the house she built to a little place down in Exeter. She had to do the plumbing. She couldn't afford a plumber. So she put these little sticks in the pavement and put sheets across them so they looked official, like council work. She dug underneath, connected all her plumbing up to the mains. I couldn't believe it. I couldn't believe it. But she could do anything. And she had this most beautiful workshop that was so filled with every tool you needed to do anything with, which people had either given her or she'd not eaten a cake to buy the next gimlet or spanner or something. Anyway, she was amazing. But previous to doing this, when I really took very seriously the life of Peggy, I did intend, and I'd do an interview with her at the back of this kid's book to do it so it turned upside down, and it had the real story of P's life for adult reading. So I did lots of interviews and I've had them all transcribed, but because they wouldn't publish this, it wasn't worth trying to get those. I still have them all in my files about how hard her life was and what she thought about things. But I do remember earlier on, which is one of the interesting things about Peg, is we all remember what a little famous little snotty-nosed kid that us girls, me and our sister, had to keep wiping her nose and had flies in their eyes. And they really were dirty, snotty little kids. And she'd come down to visit us down the Anzac Highway when people had cars in her horse and dray. She had a big old draft horse and a dray filled with 8 kids, and she'd pull up in the spare block next to our house and hook the horse up, and then all these children of multiple ages and multiple degrees of cleanliness or snot would all come in to our house for mum to serve little butterfly cakes to. And it was such a discrepancy between my mother's attempting to be middle class, and I think it's a real difficulty that she had, and Peggy just saying, bugger it all. This is us.
Here I am.
Yeah, here I am. Okay, kids, back in the dray, whip the horse, up Anzac Highway, past all the cars or behind all the cars. And she was amazing. And that's the way she saw her life. She worked. And she didn't expect anything to be free. You know? Anyway, I learned through a lot of time working with her and interviewing her, she had her own concrete mixer. I bought a chainsaw, as I told you, my partner made me take it back. But to own your own concrete mixer, that's pretty good, isn't it? So she really was. And I've done a screen print of Peggy loading up her concrete mixer to make paths and stuff, probably to mend the damage that she'd done by putting up the plumbing on the Exeter Road.
And was that the screen print that you did, was that in the exhibit, The Women Hold Up Half the Sky?
I don't know, I can't remember.
Sorry. Back on. So you were just saying you just visited the house that she built?
Yeah, it's in William Street Prospect. But it's all been altered quite a bit. It's all been upgraded to Kilburn levels. Now, what can you say about Kilburn levels? God knows what it was like before. But it was a wonder. We used to go and visit her now in my dad's car, and we used to see the house sort of slowly getting made.
So it's been standing for at least 50 years then, because she would have built it. We're talking about sometime in the 50s then, are we? That's not bad, is it?
Well, I think even earlier than that.
So built to last.
Yeah.
Now, you said to remind you about class structures, because you were going to go back and talk about class structures with social structures.
Oh, yes.
Your mum being, moving up from working class to lower middle class.
To lower middle class. Well, I think Dad's family thought they were probably middle class, so they didn't think that Mum was good enough coming from the working class to be his wife. So she always had to fight to sort of upgrade things. Dad was a Christian, and in fact they met at a local Methodist church. He was a great believer, but Mum wasn't. I think she went just because Ted was there and she caught him. And he and we little children had to go to church every Sunday. He'd go twice, we'd go once in little white nylon dresses. And then we'd have to go out to our middle class grandma's lying in bed and sing her church hymns for several hours, which my sister Tessa and I hated. Well, you never really saw her walking around. I don't know what was the... I don't even know her name, nor Grandpa's name, first name, which is a bit strange now, isn't it?
That was very common then, though, and yes, they would quite often refer to themselves as Mr. and Mrs. Yes. or Mother and Father. Yes. So when they were talking about their partner, instead of calling them by their first name,
yes.
they'd call them, you know, as in Mr. or, you know, Mother, which yes. is yes. weird. It's so yes. formal.
Yes, well, see,
wonder
I'm,
how we ever got more room.
Yeah, they met on boats going from England to Germany, and I thought... They were both stewards or stewardesses that were just did service work. My grandma was, but I've learnt since that my grandpa was a very, I think it's even bigger than able seaman. He was a captain or, you know, really, really high in the rank. And his father was very, very high in the rank, but my grandfather got seasick. Which is very embarrassing for his family.
Very unfortunate profession to decide to go into, isn't it, when you get yes. seasick?
Yes, terrible. Anyway, my father thought he needed to teach his wife, Mary, how to be appropriate and how to economise and spend their money properly. And he was an accountant. Such an efficient but wonderful man. He brought me up. He was my wonderful father and died when I was 18. But I heard that when they first got married, he put a big poster up on the back of the kitchen door with days of the week and what she should do each day and what she should spend each day to balance the budget. And all of us kids, when we got to know about this, laughed our bloody heads off. That was really funny, but there was structure and we had a good life, I think, but I didn't believe in Christianity, neither did my mother, and she would not go to church on Sundays. She'd stay at home and cook the roast Sunday dinner, and I found out later, drink quite a few sherries on the way, and she'd only go to church on Easter and Christmas. And she had this magnificent black suit with a little spray of Lily of the Valley. She had stockings that had, I don't know if you can remember, where they had a line down the back. Yeah. And then they had little steps.
Yes.
Very old, but she'd wear those. And she wouldn't shave her legs. I'd watch her as she rolled her black hair in patterns around as she pulled the stockings up.
Oh.
And she looked just so beautiful. And my father... I've never seen him, or I never saw him so proud as when Mary went to church with him Easter and Christmas. And he was beside himself. Absolutely. But he was a wonderful man. But what I was wanting to say about class basically was, is that when I went to Teachers College, our very first lecture was about class. And I can remember the guy, I can't remember his name, I probably could if I thought hard enough, little white-haired guy, put up on the blackboard, upper class, middle class, lower class, lower class, lower class, and then he asked all of us, he described all those categories. He asked all of us to write down where we fitted on that scale. I found it so appalling that we should have to think about life like that. And then he said, it doesn't matter what you've written down, because from now on you're going to be teachers and you'll all be middle class. That's what teachers are, middle class. And it was the most amazing first lecture of tertiary education. So I guess that also caused me to be a bit of a rebel. Yeah. I don't know what more to say at the moment.